So you guys, anyone, any listener, you can look up this plate. It was included on the Voyager spacecraft because that was the first spacecraft to leave our solar system. And so like Carl Sagan thought we should put a plate in there that tells anybody about humanity, like some basic things. Yeah. And so there's like a DNA molecule inscribed on it. But they also drew like a man and a woman. So on the man, there's a penis. But on the woman, she looks like a Barbie doll. There's no like genitalia because they thought that would be obscene.
I'm Paige.
And I'm Megan.
And this is Spooky Science Sisters.
Hello, you're listening to Spooky Science Sisters, a podcast where we present to you a science-based and probably very giggly discussion on all things strange and unusual. Today, I am joined by substitute sister Dr. Allison Kirkpatrick, an astronomy professor from the University of Kansas. Allison joined me previously to talk more broadly about spooky space and all the ways space is trying to kill us. But today we are here to talk about something much more specific, and that is the Fermi paradox. So for those of you who are unfamiliar, that means we will be talking about why we haven't heard from any aliens yet, despite what ancient aliens and like the UFO bros try to tell you. So Allison, do you want to tell the people who don't remember from your last episode a little bit about yourself, what your deal is, what you do, what you're interested in research-wise and space-wise? That would be great.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me back. It's really fun to be back. So I'm an astrophysicist at the University of Kansas, and my primary research is actually on supermassive black holes in galaxies far, far away. So I look at galaxies about 7 to 10 billion years in the past, and I try to find the supermassive black holes within them, figure out how they're growing, and figure out what they're doing to their host galaxy. But as a fun part of my job, I also get to teach an introductory astronomy class where we cover everything in the universe. And so one of the things that we talk a lot about is the potential for life in our own galaxy. It's one of my favorite subjects. It always gets people really enthused. And so I'm excited to talk with you about it today.
Yeah. And we have done alien and like UFO episodes before. It has been a really long time though. Like, I think UFOs was like, it was like first five episodes or something like that. So it's been a long while. Like I said, we were more broad with spooky space, and like now we're going to sort of dive into some nitty gritty stuff. Or maybe not. I don't know. Okay. So we can start with something spooky, which I know Allison knows how it works. So I'm going to make you go first. Has anything spooky happened to you recently?
So nothing spooky has happened to me, but I am, so I recently went through a divorce, and so I am alone in my house now.
Oh, I'm sorry.
And, no, it's fine. These are like the best days of my life. But so I only have my kids half the time. Uh-huh. I've got 1 9-year-old who I brought up a story. I said, do you remember when you were 4, you claimed that you had a like ghost in your closet?
Oh,
and we
no.
named her and we talked about her. And she says, oh yeah. And I see ghosts in this house too.
Oh no.
I said, what? Excuse me? She goes, yeah, I just don't tell you about them. But like, I've seen a man standing in our living room.
What?
And I named him. Yeah, she named him. I think she named him Gabriel or something. And I said, okay, so is Gabriel good or bad? And she goes, he's medium. So now I'm alone in my house right now, staring at my living room, wondering if Gabriel's standing over there watching me.
Oh, that is... Yeah. The worst thing ever.
Kids are really creepy, man.
Yeah.
Kids are the creepiest.
Kids are very creepy. Oh, no. Here, I thought you were just going to say like, oh, I'm alone more often, so I convince myself that I'm hearing weird things in the house, which is what I do the second that like I'm alone in my house. It's like, oh my God. There's someone in here with me. But yeah, no, you got like Gabriel in there who stands in your living room, whatever. That's the worst.
Right.
I don't know if I missed it. Did you say how old your daughter is?
She's nine. I mean, she's really into paranormal stuff. So she was getting really creeped out in her room. And so, you know, I am a very practical science-based person. Yeah. So I don't really believe in what I'm about to say, but it helped her. And so like we got her a dream catcher, ethically sourced, and we got some ethically sourced sage as well. And we did like a sage cleansing in her room, and we got her some crystals.
Yeah.
And it seemed to really help her.
Yeah. Yeah. The power of positive thinking, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, personally, that's what I think, because I don't believe in any of that stuff. But if you believe in it and it helps you, great.
Yeah. But also maybe you should move.
No, this house is fine. It's fine.
Okay. That is terrifying. Okay.
Well, what's your spooky thing?
Mine is not spooky at all. Mine is just very silly. So I happened to go to the Eras Tour, Taylor Swift's Eras Tour, this past summer.
Oh, nice.
Yes. And I went to the Kansas City dates in July. So I just wanted to like give a shout out to all the conspiracy theorists for doing my part to help manifest the outcome of this past weekend's Super Bowl.
Right.
Although I was there on night two and Travis Kelce was there on night one. I was like, wow, I really missed out. Being there Friday night rather than Saturday. It's fine. I made Paige go see the movie with me and she was like, this is a cult, right? And I was like, yeah, a little bit. Yeah. It's fine. Okay. So we are going to jump into the Fermi paradox or Fermi's paradox. I don't know. I see it both ways, either singular or possessive, like he owns it. I don't really know which one is correct.
I've always just seen it as the Fermi paradox.
Right. Fermi. Which way am I supposed to say it? I don't know.
I say it Fermi, but that's because I'm an American and we pronounce everything incorrectly.
Yeah, but also like you are an astrophysicist, so I feel like you probably...
Yeah, but we all say Fermi.
Would know.
No, I don't know. I don't know
about
that.
We'll do Fermi paradox. We're just going to choose one and we're going to go forward with it. Everyone knows what we mean. Chill out. not you chill out. Everyone else chill out. Okay. So what is this? This is based on a statement that was made by Enrico Fermi during a lunchtime conversation in about 1950 with some colleagues when he said, "Where is everybody?" And he was referring to the fact that the universe is obviously very vast and it is old enough that there should be other intelligent civilizations out there. Some that are much more advanced than ours, which would be capable of interstellar travel. So his question was, why the heck haven't we heard from them? And yeah, we're basically going to get into that this whole episode. So a brief bio of Fermi the man. He was an Italian physicist who built the first nuclear reactor. He won a Nobel Prize in 1938 for his work using neutron bombardment to produce new radioactive elements, as well as for his work on nuclear reactions produced by slow neutrons. He was an associate director at Los Alamos National Lab during the Manhattan Project. So he was just like all around a very brilliant, famous scientist. And I just see this story and I think, like, can you imagine like being just so brilliant that just this casual lunchtime conversation becomes this huge thing that sparks all this future research?
Yeah, it'd be pretty fun. SETI was actually born from a conversation, Carl Sagan, when in his youth, not youth, but he was very young, and Frank Drake, who I know we're going to get to, they were at a workshop at Green Bank Telescope, and they were just like messing around on the chalkboard, and it ended up leading to the Drake equation, which is related to the Fermi paradox, and that ended up leading to SETI.
Yeah, there you go.
So yeah, people used to just sit around and talk on chalkboards.
I know.
Nowadays, I don't have time for that.
Science today is very different. Now it's all like funding driven. We're all operating on like 3-year grant cycles. And it's like, man.
Gotta get that money.
Wish that we could go back to the days where it's like, let's just hang out and have lunch and talk about some science. And then like some cool things happen because of it. But also, yeah, like just, yeah, it's crazy that this is just like a lunchtime conversation and then it's turned into this huge like cultural but also like scientific phenomenon at this point. Okay. Mm-hmm. So back to the paradox. Apparently there's actually some misrepresentation as to Fermi's conclusions from this conversation about aliens. So the conclusion that Fermi actually drew was that interstellar travel must be either impossible, be found by civilizations to be not worthwhile, or civilizations never last long enough for it to be realized. And I just want to point out that, like, at this point, he's living in a world where we're still like a decade out from going to space. So things like sped up really quickly, like right after this, in terms of like making steps towards some of these things being possible. But that said, apparently it's often claimed that Fermi argued that our lack of contact with an interstellar civilization meant that they must not exist at all. So in the spirit of like debunking things, because that's what we love to do, that idea actually comes from astronomer Michael Hart, who in 1975 wrote, "They are not here, therefore they do not exist." And he goes on to conclude that it's like a waste of time and money to search for intelligent extraterrestrial life, which like, whatever, man. The confusion apparently came about in 1977 when physicist David G. Stevenson coined the phrase Fermi paradox and cited Hart's idea as a possible solution to Fermi's question. But I guess everybody read it as like Fermi didn't believe in aliens. And it's like, no, that's not the case. He just thought, yeah, like he proposed reasons why we might not have heard from them. And Fermi didn't actually say that it meant that they didn't exist. So I thought that was interesting because I feel like when I read it, I was like, oh yeah, I guess I have seen the thing saying that like it just means they're not out there. But I don't know. I must have seen like enough of the debunked version where it's like actually what he concluded or like the reasons for it that it didn't.
Right.
I don't know. But in case anyone's confused.
Right.
Okay. So regardless of any misrepresentation, when it comes to Fermi and what he concluded about us not hearing from aliens, our collective alien contact FOMO has sparked a vast array of scientific research in the last almost 75 years since this infamous lunchtime conversation. And we are going to talk about some of the reasons, again, why we haven't met the aliens yet.
Yes.
But I think in order to discuss these explanations, we first have to remind people about the Drake equation, because I think it helps to put into context like why it seems weird that we haven't heard from anybody.
Well, okay. Does it though? Because well, let's talk about the variables in the Drake equation.
Yeah.
Because I have when I teach this, I have my class make guesses for all, because this isn't like a real mathematical equation. Almost everything in it is a guess.
Right.
And so it reveals more about you. And so there are always two types of people, those who are very pessimistic in their guesses and those are very optimistic in their guesses. And you get wildly different answers based on both of those things. Because, okay, so the Drake equation. Okay, good. You have it written down. I don't have to recall it off of my head.
Yeah, I was like, I'm not going to remember this.
Right. So it's the number of possible civilizations within our galaxy. And it's important, I think, to remember that we're only talking about our galaxy, you know, and even Star Trek, which was so accurate, but so optimistic about the number of aliens out there, only ever dealt with our galaxy, because even with warp drive, that's all you could reasonably expect to travel to.
Yeah.
So light travel time from our nearest neighbor is already like millions of light years, our nearest neighbor galaxy. Uh-huh. So we're only concerned with species within our own galaxy, because when people talk about intelligent species, sometimes it's like an esoteric question, but a lot of times what people actually mean is species we could contact and exchange information with.
Yeah, I've heard like sort of the bare minimum is like, oh, they have to have developed radio, because that's a signal that it's a simple technology. Mm-hmm. And also it's like able to escape out or be sent out into space as a signal.
Right. Okay. So the first term in this equation is the rate at which the Milky Way forms stars. So we know this. It is about 3 stars per year. Then the next one is the fraction of those stars that have planets. Okay, based on the exoplanet field, which, you know, has just been booming since 1995, we now think that it is the fraction of stars that have planets is 1, or very close to 1. We think that planets are a natural byproduct of star formation.
Okay, yeah. So meaning that, like, if we want to put that in percentage for people who don't think in, like, fractions, about like
100%. 100%. Yeah. 100%.
Yeah.
Okay, so then next is the number of planets that have an environment that can support life. Now we're getting into the made-up numbers. All right, so already we're into the made-up numbers. Now we have 5 made-up numbers that are coming. So based on our own solar system, which, you know, an interesting side note here, Carl Sagan just believed that there was tons of life out in the Milky Way. Mm-hmm. And the reason that he believed that is what is called the assumption of mediocrity. So during his lifetime, this was the only solar system that he could study. And so you have to assume that what you're living in isn't special. Okay. Yeah. You have to assume you're not special. That is usually the starting hypothesis. As we can get into a bit later, it looks like we're actually pretty special. And so his assumption was incorrect. Okay. And so once we started finding other planetary systems, there's a lot of stuff that doesn't look like ours. But so based on our own solar system, there's 2, maybe 3 planets in the habitable zone. Okay. So maybe Venus is like right on the edge. Uh-huh. But Earth and Mars definitely had the capability for life. We can look at other multi-planet systems. So the TRAPPIST system is one that's very well known. That's got about 7 planets around it. And again, I think it has 3 planets in the habitable zone, or right on the edge. Hmm. So I think 2 to 3 is a reasonable guess.
Okay.
For the number of planets that have an environment that could support life.
Okay.
Okay. So next one is the fraction of those planets that can support life on which life actually develops. Well, again, we only have our own solar system. So let's say there's 3 planets in our habitable zone. The only one that we know of with life is Earth. And we've looked pretty hard on Mars and haven't found it yet. So 1/3, 50% to 1/3 might be a reasonable guess there.
Yeah. I'm holding out hope for one of Jupiter's moons.
Be nice, but that's not in the habitable zone. So that's already not in the inn that we estimated just a second ago.
Okay.
Okay. So the Drake equation has some problems, right? Because if moons turn out to be habitable, and we know that lots of planets have moons, then that increases our chances.
True.
So now here's you. You're gonna get to guess. I'm gonna keep track of the numbers that we said. I'm gonna multiply them together.
Okay.
And I'm gonna tell you the answer that we get based on your guesses. Okay. So we had 3 stars per year forming in the Milky Way.
Okay.
We're gonna say that 100% of those form life. We're gonna be optimistic. We're gonna say that 3 are in the habitable zone, and we're gonna say that 1/3 of those goes on to form intelligent life. All right, sorry, 1/3 of those goes on to form life.
Okay.
Now you need to guess what fraction of planets with life does life become intelligent? So here's what I make my students do.
Okay.
what is intelligence? In this case, it's radio communication, right? We're going to get there.
Yeah.
But, well, actually, we're going to get there in a different variable. Yeah. So in this case, it can just be intelligence. So if you look at all the species on Earth, all the millions of species that there are, what fraction of those would you call intelligent?
I don't know. Really, they've got like slime molds who are solving mazes. So...
But then I want to throw in a couple of other complicating factors here. Uh-huh. So if you can't tell already, I'm a pessimist.
That's fine.
So some other complicating factors is that the dominant life form on Earth for 3 billion years was algae.
Yeah.
It wasn't, we didn't get anything beyond that, anything beyond single-celled organisms until like the last 500 million years.
Yeah, right.
So you can take that as your fraction as well.
Mm-hmm.
So you can also look at extinction events. If the dinosaurs hadn't become extinct, what would life look like?
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know. You have to make a guess. What percentage of planets with life go on to develop intelligent life?
I'm going to say, I don't know. I'll say like 1%.
Okay. That's not awful. I'm putting that in. Okay, great. All right. Now, here's the next one. The fraction of those planets with intelligent civilizations that then develop the technology for communication.
So we talked about radio and how that's a pretty simple technology. And so I think the consensus is that they think like most intelligent civilizations would be able to develop it. So I would guess high on that one. Okay. I would say like, I don't know, 75%.
Okay, that's fine.
Okay.
Okay. And then finally, the average lifetime that you can then communicate. So you've got your radio technology. Uh-huh. So we've only had radio technology for about 100 years.
Huh?
So this is, again, a pessimist optimist question.
Yeah.
At what point do you think we're going to extinct ourselves? So how long can you use your technological communication?
Oh, I feel like I skew towards being a pessimist about this.
Okay.
So we've only had it for like 100 years.
Yeah.
We've come really far in that time.
And global warming is an imminent threat.
But also, we're not doing great. I'll say the pessimist. Well, I'll split the difference. I'll say like 10,000 years.
10,000 years. Oh, wow. Okay. All right. So it's pretty good. So according to your guesses, there are 222 alien civilizations, intelligent alien civilizations in the Milky Way.
There you go.
Yeah. So with my pessimist guess, I always get like 4 or less than 1.
Yeah. Okay. Because, yeah, so I think it's funny because one of the examples that I put in the notes was somebody, like, they came up with like 12,500. And I was like, that's absurd. Like,
it all depends. So the way that you get those big numbers is by how long you think that your highly intelligent species is going to last once they develop communication.
Yeah. So, yeah, they said 1 million years for theirs. And I was like, right. I don't know about that. But you thought 10,000 sounded high.
I think 10,000 is too high. So this is one of the answers to the Fermi paradox, right? Which is that no civilization, once it becomes this technologically advanced, civilizations just don't last very long.
Yeah.
And so we'll never find each other because something happens. It's called like the Great Wall or the Great Filter. And you filter yourself out, which we're, you know, we're facing imminent nuclear threat. I mean, we could wipe out everybody with nuclear bombs right now. We're facing threat from climate change. So there are big threats right now. So if that is a natural consequence of having an intelligent civilization, which again, all we have to look at is us, then nobody would survive very long.
Yeah. So it's funny that that example is like 12,500, which is absurd because I had seen estimates before that ranged from like 4 to like 2 something. So I guess I am on like the higher side of things. Do your students tend to come up with, like, do they tend to be more pessimistic or optimistic?
They split into two camps.
Yeah.
About it.
Gotcha.
But so then the next question I ask students, and I'll ask you too, is one of the ideas behind SETI that was put forth in the 80s is that we can actually magnify our communications. So we could put out like a giant pulse of a communication signal that would be like unmistakable if somebody out there saw it.
Yeah.
And this was pretty hotly debated as to whether or not we should do it.
Uh-huh.
What do you think? Should we do it? Should we try to find alien civilizations and contact them?
Well, I feel like past me would have said, absolutely, let's do it. And then when I started reading more about the Fermi paradox and explanations for it and why you might not want to do that, I was like, maybe not. But also, like, what are the chances? Like, you send out that pulse, it goes out in one direction. Like, the chances of it actually being received by someone are just so small that it's like, sure, whatever. Take a shot in the dark and see what happens.
Right. Yeah, I think this is one of those interesting questions which you named, I see in the notes here, we're going to talk about the movie Contact, which is lovely and just this like beautiful, hopeful view.
Yeah.
It's the only alien movie that's like that. Every other alien movie, we get destroyed.
So, yeah. It's not great.
it's not great.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, yeah. So we're going to, that's what makes it spooky.
I'm Eliza, and I need you to listen to me. Have you ever felt so much that you don't know where to put it all? And you wonder if anyone would notice if you screamed? Because you want to. Scream for the ones they've hurt. The ones they've taken. Scream for yourself. These are my words, my story from my perspective, because I know you'll hear other versions, because I want you to have a chance to believe mine, or at least hear it. If you're getting this, it's already over. But if one of you listens, really listens, it won't be for nothing.
Okay. Well, yeah. So I guess a few minutes ago, I said, you know, if we look at some of the solutions for the Drake equation, it seems like some people will say there's like so many civilizations out there.
Right.
You know, why haven't we heard from them? Because there could be thousands, whatever. But yeah, I'm sort of with you that it's like, maybe there's like hundreds, but I guess my thoughts are like we've only had like radio broadcasts for like the last 100 years. We're few years over that point. We've only had flight for like about 100 years. So it's like, and we've come so far in that amount of time. So it's like, just if a civilization was able to survive and, you know, not get filtered out in some way, which we will talk more about, like even just having 1,000 years on us or 10,000 years on us, like I don't even think we can imagine like what we'll be capable of at that point, you know?
Right.
So I don't know. To me, it's like, yeah, like they should be out there. They should be getting out there and doing stuff in space.
Sure. But that requires them to be like fundamentally different from us.
Sure.
Because if you look at our technological advancements, I mean, you mentioned UFOs in the beginning, right?
Yeah.
UFOs are almost always some technology that the military has that people don't understand.
Yeah.
Because the technology that the military has is insane. Like you have no idea.
Yeah.
And so all of our technological advancements are going towards the military.
Yeah.
Not space travel,
true,
building a moon base, colonizing Mars, you know, interstellar travel. I mean, we've sent one interstellar probe, and that was Voyager, and that was launched in the 70s.
Yeah. We are going back to the moon.
So again,
soon,
it gets back to my pessimistic view of if we are mediocre, then every alien civilization is out there investing all their technology into the military to destroy themselves.
If we're average, yeah. So, okay. All right. That aside.
Yes. All right, let's talk about things. I mean, I'm going to present an explanation that you haven't mentioned on here, but go ahead.
I'm excited about it. We'll start with the simpler ones. Yeah. So we've got the Fermi paradox. We've got the Drake equation. It tells us that, like, maybe there should be some other smarty pants out there, but we don't really know. But also, like, why haven't we heard from them? So a couple of explanations we've already mentioned. As Michael Hart said, no one's out there. And I started thinking about this the other night and, like, really got myself into, like, an existential pickle, because I was like, what if that means we're either the first or the last? Mm-hmm. And, like, I am not clear which one of those would be worse.
Right.
Like, what would you say? Would you say you'd rather be the first that's, like, capable of any of this? Or would you rather be, like, would it freak you out less to be the last one standing?
Okay, so I do think we're alone, so that's going to be my solution to this. I know, I'm so sorry, but I'm going to tell you why I think that, but I'll tell you later. So
that makes me very uncomfortable.
I would say we would be the last.
Okay.
Because the universe actually formed most of its stars 10 billion years ago.
Okay.
So, like, that's the epoch that I study. It's like the heyday of star formation in the universe. Uh-huh. So when you look up at night, 50% of the stars that you see were formed 10 billion years ago.
Yeah.
Okay. So if planetary formation is a common byproduct of star formation, that's when you should get, like, the most planets.
Yeah.
And then let's say it does take a few billion years for life to develop. That would still put most of your intelligent civilizations, you know, maybe like 5 to 6 billion years in the past.
Yeah.
And then their host star is going to die. So
that's such a bummer.
Maybe. Yeah. So star formation is winding down in our galaxy.
Yeah.
So not in other galaxies, but in our galaxy, it is. Yeah. Star formation is winding down.
Yeah. Okay.
Although it'll be reignited again when we collide with Andromeda.
Wee. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. I don't know. For me, definitely, like, being the last is the scarier option, but great. Makes me feel really good when an astronomer is like, or an astrophysicist is like, yeah, we're probably last.
Well, but it's all made up anyway. None of this matters. We can't. Okay. We can't meaningfully contact or exchange ideas with a technologically advanced civilization.
I know.
So this is all just, like, fun and games.
I know. Okay.
Okay. But I will say, okay, so let me put in a plug for SETI, actually.
Okay.
So SETI, it was one of these organizations, I don't remember who exactly started it, but the person who revolutionized it and made it like a really scientific, legitimate organization is Dr. Jill Tarter. Mm-hmm. And Carl Sagan wrote Contact based on her.
Yeah.
So the character of Ellie Arroway is based on Jill Tarter.
Yeah.
So SETI is actually getting a lot smarter in how it searches for, because now we know of all these exoplanets, right? And mm-hmm. we know of things that could be habitable based on their properties. Mm-hmm. And so now you can actually do a viable radio signal search by pointing your radio telescope at these exoplanets, right, and listening for signals.
Right. Yeah. We actually, like, have a place to aim.
Yes, it maximizes, like, the chances of this.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, and if any of you have not at least watched the movie Contact, like, that's your homework.
Yes.
Because it's so absolutely. Good. It's so good. It's
such a good movie.
Yeah.
It's such a good movie, and it's such a good insight into, like, how modern astronomy is done, mm-hmm. Taking data with telescopes, arguing for funding, getting mad at your collaborators, like, all these things.
Yeah, yeah. Although it makes me very sad that the Arecibo Observatory is no longer there, like the big telescope, because I've been there.
Yep.
It's cool. Okay, so first or last, whatever. So I guess we should clarify. So you're going to go into this more later, but when you say, like, you think we're alone, do you mean, like, the entire universe, or do you mean we're talking specifically about the Milky Way?
I think we're talking about the Milky Way. Okay. But I think when I say we're alone, I think we are meaningfully alone.
Okay.
Meaning there could be other intelligent civilization. We're never going to detect them or talk to them. Yeah. So what does it matter? My students, I often get comments in my class that I give them an existential crisis.
It matters because I don't know. That's the great question, right? Where did we come from? Why are we here? And that's sort of an answer. If there's like other civilizations out there.
Sure.
I don't know. Okay. Well, regardless, like Michael Hart says, no one's out there. I think like if on the universe scale, like unlikely, but I do understand saying like meaningfully we are alone. But like there has to be, like I think it's essentially impossible that there's no life out there at all. Like there's something out there.
Right. Right. Sure.
Okay. So one of the other big reasons is that interstellar travel may be impossible or too costly.
Right. So this goes back to the original Fermi paradox where he was like, where is everybody? Meaning he thought that aliens would colonize planets and then move on and keep colonizing planets.
I know. It's like such a weird, there's so much about it where they're like, yeah, it would be like the natural impulse.
It's the natural thing.
Of everyone to like go out and like colonize space and take over everyone else.
Spoken by like, a European man.
I know.
Of course.
I was like, what the fuck are you guys talking about?
Yes. Right. Yes, it's a very white European centric idea.
Totally.
But I don't think people like people who participate in SETI and stuff and who are searching for intelligence don't think that that's happening, that that's necessarily a given. I mean, look at us. We haven't even gotten back to the moon in like 50 years.
Sure. So. Yeah.
Yeah. And we love to colonize.
I know. Yeah. If anyone's going out to colonize, like it's definitely us. And like we can barely make it to our own moon right now. So that is a good point. But we do have a space force now, Allison. So.
That's true.
Good Lord. Yes. So, yeah. And a good point to make here is like, we're like nowhere near the technology. Like you'd have to move. I know there's science behind like what fraction of like light speed you'd have to move at, or if you'd have to like bend space around you or some like insane stuff that I don't understand. But like with our current technology, even just to get to Proxima Centauri, which is our closest neighbor, it would take us more than 70,000 years. And that's only like four light years. Yeah. So we'd basically like, if the day comes where we're like, yeah, like we are colonizing space, it's probably more of like a, like we're just sending people out to another planet or a moon or something to like make a colony, not that we're like going out to find other people or anything. So we're not going to get very far. Okay. The next big thing is that something might be up with how we are communicating. So it could be that we haven't heard back from anybody because any signals that we have sent out haven't made it far enough. Radio signals travel at the speed of light, and we've been broadcasting, like I said, for just over about 100 years. So they've made it like 100 light years away in all directions, but that's like nothing in the scheme of things. The Milky Way is about 100,000 light years across.
Right.
Yeah.
And it's nothing. It's not very far, but it's also our radio signals are pretty weak.
They degrade, right?
Right. And so this has been one of the advancements with SETI. So when SETI first got started, like in the late 60s, early 70s, like they thought they were going to hear radio signals like right away.
Yeah.
And then when they get in, they realized, well, you need to build a more powerful telescope. And even now, even with the telescopes we have now, we'd only be able to hear certain radio broadcasts from other planets.
Yeah.
You know, we still need a bigger telescope to make a complete search of our neighborhood.
Yeah. it's hard to hear the signals, and it's also like we haven't sent ours very far, and like you're sort of just gambling, like maybe somebody's gonna pick it up and realize it means anything. Isn't just random noise. Which right. That was what blew my mind, and I had no idea about like the static, like even just on like a regular radio, it's like 10 or 20% of that is just like cosmic noise, like just
yes.
And that's
right.
That's crazy to me. Like you can just like, I don't know, hear the universe through your radio. It just feels like a very profound thing, but it's like, I don't know. It weirds me out. I do think it's a little bit funny that the first TV broadcast that would have been strong enough to penetrate the ionosphere and escape into space was of Hitler opening the 1936 Olympic Games.
Yay, legacy for humanity.
So our furthest TV broadcast, which again has probably degraded too much for anyone to like actually get anything out of the signal. But yeah, that's the one that we sent out first. So
yeah, but just think about how much of our stuff is going into space. Like how much of what we listen to and watch is basically just trash.
Yeah.
And how much would we actually be proud for another civilization to pick up?
That has been like my favorite meme going around in like the last week or so, because we just passed Groundhog Day. Groundhog Day. And the meme is just like it says like alien, like, and the groundhog is clairvoyant, and like the person responds and they're just yeah. like, yes. Yes. That's yes. exactly how it works. Like, don't worry about it. I know, just like all the weird things that could be picked up, but it's like, who even knows? Like, yeah. All right. Yeah, you already kind of mentioned this with SETI, but again, like we haven't figured out the right way to look, or we haven't looked in the right place. We are getting better at that with like discovering more exoplanets, but yeah, bigger telescopes, but nobody's going to give anybody funding for that.
Right.
I did think an interesting point was that there are probably fewer, or they're not probably, there are fewer stray radio signals from Earth that are being sent out into space as our communications technologies advance. So like a lot of
yes.
sort of long distance right. communication gets like bounced up to a satellite and then bounced back to Earth.
Bounced down. Yes.
So like it's not going out into space. So one of the points that somebody brought up was like, oh, well, maybe like everybody develops radio, but then like a little over 100 years later, we all just go silent because we right. figured out more local ways to communicate. So we don't need to like just sort of beam this signal out everywhere.
Right.
Yeah. Which I think is a really good point to think about is like, well, yeah, like maybe it's just something really simple like that. Okay. So now we get to like the ones that really freak me out.
Yeah.
So the first of these ones that really scares me, which Allison mentioned before, is the Great Filter. And I'm like positive that if you have read about the Fermi Paradox at all, you've probably heard about this before. But for those who haven't, it's this idea that there is something that happens that destroys life on a planet either before any intelligent life is able to develop or before they can advance far enough to achieve interstellar travel. So like basically we all have to pass through, every form of life in the universe has to pass through this like great filter event. And some would argue that like nobody makes it to the other side. So that's why we
right.
don't hear from anybody. So this could be something as basic as abiogenesis, which means simply like the actual emergence of life from lifelessness. So maybe we are really special, like the fact that life was able to develop in the absence of it on Earth, like might just be a very rare thing. Could be, like we talked about in Spooky Space, all the things in space that are trying to kill us. Like maybe space is just too hazardous. And so everybody yeah. that we might communicate with who's close enough has been destroyed by like an impact event or a gamma ray burst or just something horrific happening to their planet or their species or whatever, which is basically like the take-home lesson that I got from talking to you the last time you were on the show. I'm just waiting at this point. The third, which Allison already touched on, is that intelligent civilizations might just tend to destroy themselves. So yeah. Again, thermonuclear weapons. We are doing a super great, awesome job of heating our planet up to the point where we might not be able to survive on it anymore. So, you know, that might happen to everybody. Everybody gets a little bit too big for their own planet and they just die off. Yeah. And I think one of the things that makes this especially spooky, so like if this is a solution to the Fermi paradox, the question sort of becomes like, is the great filter behind us? Like maybe we survived, like because mammals, you know, survived the last mass extinction. Like maybe that was the great filter and like now it's behind us and we're good. Or maybe life evolved or life formed at all on this planet because the filter was just like life coming out of lifelessness, which is really hard phrase to say. But it's like definitely more unsettling to think like, what if we haven't reached the great filter yet, which is probably the more likely answer. So not ideal.
Yeah, I think it's an interesting question.
Yeah.
The more technologically advanced that we get, mm-hmm. the more capable we are with dealing with the hazards from space, mm-hmm. right? Like a comet hitting us.
That's true.
Isn't the same threat to us as it was to the dinosaurs, because now we have early detection systems that are getting better all the time. We know how we could move a comet as long as we have enough time to do it. We have spacecraft that have traveled to comets. So we could defend ourselves from that, right? Mm-hmm. Gamma ray bursts close to our planet, no one's really worried about because there aren't any potential sources.
Yeah.
Oh, except for Betelgeuse. But Betelgeuse, it's debatable whether or not that's close enough. And then with technology, the problem with what we're doing to ourselves right now is that we have the technology to not do it.
Yeah.
And so we have the technology to solve global warming.
Yeah.
It's not a problem that we haven't developed the technology. We have. The problem is our geopolitical systems.
Yeah. So maybe hopefully everyone isn't as big of assholes as we are.
Yeah, basically. You basically have to hope that aliens have a completely different personality.
Yeah, like so. They're a little less I don't know what the right way to put it is, but they're a little more interested in, I guess, like helping the greater good than we are at the moment. Right. yeah. So the great filter is kind of scary, but who knows? It makes sense. Okay. So now we get into some of the ones that are like a little more out there.
Oh, I love the dark forest hypothesis. Oh, wait. So the dark forest hypothesis is pretty awesome. So, because it comes from a sci-fi book where this alien civilization is coming to destroy Earth, and Earth has to figure out how to defend itself. And so in this book, the main character puts forth the dark forest hypothesis, which is that there's lots of alien civilizations out there. It's just there's limited resources in the universe. And so every civilization needs to hide from other, they're both hunting and fighting at the same time. So it's like, you know, it's like Predator. And it's akin to walking through a dark forest full of these silent, deadly hunters that are invisible to you.
Yeah.
So that's the idea. So when we put out our radio pulses, we're being idiots and we're broadcasting, hey, we're here.
Yeah. Was it Voyager that had like the disc on it? Or
yeah.
Yeah. Which Voyager hasn't made it.
Yeah. So it was Voyager that had the disc broadcasting who we were.
Yeah. We're like, we're just sending out all these signals like, hey, here we are. Come find us. And it's like, everybody else is like, shut the fuck up. Like, why are you doing this?
Hey, side note about the Voyager disc. Uh-huh. I don't know if you know this or not. If you look at the man and the woman on it, uh-huh. So you guys, anyone, any listener, you can look up this plate. It was included on the Voyager spacecraft because that was the first spacecraft to leave our solar system. And so like Carl Sagan thought we should put a plate in there that tells anybody about humanity, like some basic things. Yeah. And so there's like a DNA molecule inscribed on it. But they also drew like a man and a woman. So on the man, there's a penis. But on the woman, she looks like a Barbie doll. There's no like genitalia because they thought that would be obscene.
I honestly have not, like, I've seen pictures of it and I've never really put that together that, like, yeah, the woman just doesn't have any genitals. Well, what are you gonna do? If somebody finds it and then they come find us, it'll just be a surprise.
They'll be confused.
Yeah. So I think, like, just the dark forest hypothesis is, I mean, yeah, it's science fiction, but I don't know, man. It creeps me out.
It is. It's very creepy.
It's very creepy. And I think the first book, so The Dark Forest, I think is the second book in the...
Is the second one. Yeah. Yes.
And it's the three body problem.
Yes, the three body problem is the first one where the astronomer like advertises her position to the aliens. She realizes like what they do. She advertises a position, and because she's so disillusioned with life on Earth.
Oh, okay. Well, that is like imminently, I guess, spoiler alert, because that's imminently about to become a show on Netflix. So,
oh, is it? Mm-hmm. Oh, that's cool.
Yeah, it will premiere in the middle of March or third week of March, but it's what the Game of Thrones guys went to do after they finished that.
Oh God.
Which is not particularly encouraging. Well, not
watching that. No, this is going to be horrible.
The previews of it look pretty good though. So I don't know.
Sure. We'll see. Then you can cut a whole thing down to 2 minutes. Absolutely.
Yeah. We'll see. We'll see. I'm going to hold out hope that it will be good because I think, yeah, hopefully they just like stick to the source material this time.
Okay. Yeah.
Yeah. And that's like essentially like also the plot of Independence Day.
Yes. Yes. Exactly. Is that this alien civilization is gathering resources. Yeah.
They're like parasites and they're coming to like take all our resources or whatever. So it's a good one. Okay. The next one is the zoo hypothesis, which I like.
I love
it. It was first proposed in 1973 by John Ball and suggests that while advanced alien civilizations exist and they know about us and could communicate with us if they wanted to, they have like some sort of interstellar agreement that there's like a hands-off policy when it comes to Earth and other developing planets that like have not yet developed interstellar travel and communication. But it's also like, maybe just tell us about it if that's the case.
Yeah. Yeah, so it's like the Prime Directive.
Yeah, it's like Star Trek's Prime Directive.
Which is broken on Star Trek all the time.
Yeah, so. Well... They have to have something to create drama. But I think like the idea is like we would freak out if they came and told us about it. So they have to let us develop it ourselves and then we'll feel better. But I guess like related to that, there is something called MEDI International, which MEDI stands for Messaging Extraterrestrial Intelligence. They've been beaming radio signals to nearby star systems.
All right, shut up. It's a dark forest. No.
In the hopes that someone will answer. So, and their logic is like, so why it's called the zoo hypothesis is like their logic is if an animal at the zoo started talking to you, like, wouldn't you talk back to it?
I'd get my head checked would be my first stop.
But yeah, so all this talk about like, yeah, someone's gonna come and take all our resources and kill us if they find us, but it's like, don't worry, we're sending out these signals all the time. So yeah. But and also I feel like I would see in that case, I feel like I would take the more pessimistic view, because we were joking about how we're like, oh, of course, like all the colonizers would be like, yeah, we're going to go out and colonize space. But it's like,
yeah.
But also, like, I suppose I do sort of err on the side of like aliens aren't going to like respect our privacy or whatever. Like, they're probably going to be like us and just be like, let's go see what's going on.
Right. Right.
So I don't know. Okay, so we've done some science fiction. We've done some science. You said you have another explanation for the Fermi paradox that we did not talk about yet.
Yeah, sure. So my personal belief, okay, because it is a belief, it's not really scientifically testable, is that we're alone. But the reason why is because we now know that we are not, in fact, mediocre. We are very, very special. And the more that we find out about other planets around other stars, the more special we turn out to be. And so, right, so the way that life arose on Earth is probably in a tide pool. People have done experiments of like mixing lightning and the conditions of a tide pool, and they've been able to create amino acids that way. How you actually get the first life spark, no one's been able to do or really understands why. But so, okay, so you need a planet with tides. Well, what causes the tides? It's our moon. And the fact that we have a moon at all is a large moon. That's pretty special. No other planet in our solar system has a moon comparable in size to the planet. Mm-hmm. Well, except for Pluto. We're not going to talk about Pluto. We don't talk about Pluto. Venus doesn't have this kind of moon. Mars doesn't have this kind of moon. It happened because of a chance encounter. Probably Jupiter had something to do with it. Probably Jupiter's gravity disturbed another planet and flung it in, and it collided with Earth. And it happened, the collision happened to be just right in order to form our moon. But our moon does a lot of things for us. So it gives us tides, which we think were essential to forming life.
Mm-hmm.
And then it stabilizes our planet so that we have very stable temperatures, because without the moon, we'd wobble a whole bunch. And then we also have a nearly circular orbit. So Mars's orbit is a bit more elliptical. And so Mars's seasons vary a lot more than Earth's do. We're also the right size to have a magnetic field. So even if Mars had an ocean, number one, if Mars had an ocean, it wouldn't have had tides. So if tides are essential, Mars wouldn't have been able to form life that way. But then Mars lost its ocean because it just wasn't quite the right size. And that's due to the effect of Jupiter. But then you get to, so already that sets Earth apart as being pretty special. Then you start to look at like the sizes of our planets and the distance that they are from the sun.
Mm-hmm.
That's pretty special too. So it turns out, as we're starting to take these demographics of other planets around other stars, that the most common type of planet that the universe prefers to form is a Neptune-sized planet. So planets the size of Earth are rarer. So you get these fluffy Neptune planets that then wouldn't have a surface for life to develop on.
Mm-hmm.
But then the final thing that makes us pretty special. So there's the spacing, there's the size of the planets, there's the fact that we have a moon. There is the fact that we have gas giants, mm-hmm, located pretty far out. That's also is turning out to be pretty rare, and it's essential because you need to get water on your planet, and there is no water. So when the solar system's forming, there's no water in the inner solar system.
Mm-hmm.
All the water is in the outer solar system. So you need to have some mechanism that flings comets into the inner solar system very frequently so that comets can impact the surface and deliver all the ice that's on them. So Jupiter and Saturn play that role in our solar system.
Hmm.
So we think that Jupiter and Saturn were essential for delivering water. But if these types of planets are not common, and they don't seem to be now that we have an accurate census of what solar systems look like, then you wouldn't have this water delivery mechanism in other solar systems.
Hmm.
So, yeah. So I think my guess is, and is just that scientifically, we seem to be pretty special.
Mm-hmm.
And so I don't think we're going to find another planet that looks exactly like ours. Mm-hmm. And this is the only planet that we have to base life on.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it's unlikely to find something as special as we are.
Yeah.
Within our neighborhood.
Yeah, there. Just let me hold on to this little shred of
sure,
hope.
If that makes you feel better, yes.
I don't even need it to be the Milky Way. Just as long as like somebody is out there in the universe.
Okay, somebody is out there in the universe. Uh-huh.
I know we're not going to hear from them. Okay. It's like a comfort civilization. Okay. They're just out there. I just don't want us to be special.
I know. But, you know, we might be.
Yeah.
We might be pretty special. So it would be really cool. It would be super cool if we found radio signals. And there are going to be a lot of reports, I bet, claiming that they're finding life on other planets with JWST.
Yeah.
The media is going to sensationalize them. They aren't true. It's really hard, right? It's really hard. So what JWST is going to do, or what people are doing and already publishing results on this, is they're looking, you can see planetary atmospheres and you can measure the molecules in planetary atmospheres. They're looking for ratios that can't be explained naturally. So like if you were to look at our atmosphere and you were to see the amount of carbon and CO2 and oxygen and water, you can't explain those. That's not a naturally occurring ratio.
Mm-hmm.
The problem is that it's never exclusive to life. It's sure. You usually can do it by volcanism as well.
Yeah. Volcanoes are screwing things up.
I know.
Well, I think that's all the thoughts that I have about it. At least all the semi-intelligent ones.
Yeah, this was great. I think it covered it pretty well.
Yeah.
So movies I will plug is definitely Contact if you haven't seen it. And in fact, Contact, for any of you young listeners out there, the opening sequence was a marvel of technology. So the filmmaker, who was it? Robert Zemeckis, I think, right?
Yeah, I think so.
Basically took images from Hubble. So it's all real images, and then created a fly through. So he took the images and then he like 3D-ified them and created a fly through. So yeah, it's really awesome.
Huh. I guess I never really put that together, but yeah, now that you're saying it, it's all coming back to me. It's been like a few years since I've watched that movie, but it's all coming back to me now.
And then I'd also like to plug Alien.
Okay.
Not scientifically accurate, but one of my favorite movies.
I appreciate it. I have I love that movie and I love the sequel. And honestly, like I've watched, I think most of the other sequels because it's just like, I don't know, you gotta.
yeah.
I have like such a soft spot for Prometheus, which is like in the Aliens universe, but.
Get. Out. I hated that movie.
I know. I'm so like in the minority. Because I just liked the vibes. Like I liked that it was creepy, and I thought like the acting was good, and I loved the like scenery and stuff that they showed and everything. But I do know that some of it was just like so dumb. So dumb. Like my husband and I make fun of the because I have a geologist by training and he's like in there. It's like, my guy, like your job is literally to make maps of this place.
Yeah.
Like you got lost in here. And then they like find the aliens and he's like, I like rocks. I don't give a shit about aliens. And it's like, no one would say that. Like you'd just be excited to find aliens.
Right.
Yeah. But also the fact that people like run in a straight line, like rather than to the side when something's rolling towards them, it's not great.
No.
I recognize that it's not great, but I just love it anyway.
Okay, so but for a better creepy movie, did you see the new Predator?
I did not. The one with the Native Americans. I want to so
badly. Oh my god, that one was great.
Yeah, I've never seen the original, so I've been told.
No, I've never seen the original either.
Oh, okay.
I was intrigued. I didn't care about the original. I was intrigued by the premise of taking an alien and pitting them against Native American technology.
Yeah.
So that was – it was really fun. Yeah. I definitely recommend it.
Yeah, I know. I got to watch it. But my husband was like, you haven't seen the original. You have to watch that first. I was like, whatever.
No, you don't need to. No.
Okay. So official things that we should do. Do you want to just give people one last reminder of where they can find you if you want them to
– I want them to find me. I mean, look, I'm on the dying cesspool that is Twitter right now.
It's X. So now. Reluctant.
I'm not saying that. And I am so reluctant to learn another technology, another social media site. So I'm still there.
I know.
Yeah. That's it.
Yeah. That's fine. We'll link to your Twitter or X or whatever the F we're supposed to call it now.
Half my followers are not now. So.
Oh. Yeah, I'll put links to some of the other critical things that we talked about, like the Voyager disc and the Barbie doll genitals.
That wraps up our episode on the Fermi Paradox. Join me next time for some spine-chilling stories about spooky lakes featuring substitute sister Geo Rutherford. If you liked this episode, hit subscribe and share with a friend. Check the show notes for links to all of our social media accounts, our Discord server, and Patreon. If you have any questions about previous topics or ideas for future episodes, email us at spookysciencesisters@gmail.com. As always, thank you for listening and stay spooky.
Spooky Science Sisters is a proud member of the Evergreen Podcasts Network. For more information or to check out other shows, please visit evergreenpodcasts.com.
History is complicated. The story of human progress is long, messy, and riddled with controversies big and small. On Conflicted, we dive headfirst into history's most infamous events and contentious figures. We try and untangle the good from the bad, the fact from the fiction, and the monsters from the misunderstood. Was Genghis Khan a murderous butcher or a civic pioneer? Did the Allied powers go too far in firebombing the German city of Dresden at the twilight of World War II? And how did the Marquis de Sade acquire such a sinister reputation? And was any of it true? These are just a few of the tough questions we wrestle with and investigate on Conflicted. So if you love history or just enjoy a good story, please join me, your host, Zach Cornwell, for a fascinating new topic each and every month. Conflicted, a history podcast, is available on Spotify, Apple, or wherever else you get your podcasts. I hope to see you soon.